Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Not even a life-altering explosion can stop a hero during difficult times. Attend the opening ceremony at Firehouse World in February 2011 to hear Marine Corporal Joshua Blyle share about a bombing in Iraq that took both his legs. You'll leave motivated to face whatever challenges may come your way when you're out on your next call. Get complete details at firehouseworld.com.
You are listening to Training and Tactics Talk on Radio at Firehouse.com. Training and Tactics Talk is a monthly podcast featuring fire service leaders and instructors from across the United States. Training and Tactics Talk addresses real tactical operations from a street-level perspective, along with focusing on the cutting-edge training for the modern-day fire service. The focus of Training and Tactics is to provide you, the firefighter and the fire officer, the information that you need for your job and to make you a safer fire service and to be more effective and efficient as we go through addressing the key issues that are definitely facing today's fire service. The mission of Training and Tactics Talk is to help develop predicated knowledge, skills, and abilities to ensure that everyone goes home. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, and joining me today is a plethora of knowledge featuring some of the nation's best in the fire service educators. On this edition of Training and Tactics Talk, we're going to be exploring several dimensions, and we're going to look at the modern fire service in a whole new perspective. And what we really want to get down to today is how does it apply to us in the fire service on the street level, as we're going to focus on the training that's going to be required for this modern fire combat tactics as the dynamics of fire, our environments are ever evolving and ever changing. Joining me today are guests that are across the United States, and with me today is two mentors that I am just pleased to have as mentors. They've taught me a lot through the years. And the first one is retired Chief Dave Dotson. I got Chief of Training Christopher Nam from the Command Institute in Washington, D.C. I got Assistant Chief Darren, a.k.a. Pat Wilson, from down in Georgia at Johns Creek. And from Helling out in Kansas, I've got Lieutenant Rick Mosier. Well, let me tell you a little bit about these great folks. Dave Dotson, 25 years in the trenches, ranging all the way through the ranks to B.C. He was assigned to training, safety, emergency management. He was into hazmat. He spent most of his time in recent years out on the road teaching and writing books, helping us become a safer fire service. And, of course, Chief Dotson is the owner and lead instructor for Response Solutions. And, of course, anybody that knows Chief Dotson knows that the art of reading smoke and the art of first do is right down his line. And, of course, one of his true loves back in the day and still is a hardcore passion for him is the incident safety officer in that academy that he does. He also has a book out through Del Mar. It's the Incident Safety Officer book. He's a longtime member of the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, and, of course, he's got the art of reading smoke. Puts on a power-packed dynamic program. If you ever get the chance to see Dave at one of our nation's conferences, take time to stop in and see him in the art of reading smoke. If you want him, give him a call. You can find him on the website with looking at that response solutions. Chris Nam joins us as well. 35 years in the fire service, a chief officer and a fire safety coordinator, and he brings a different dynamic to the table. Not only does he have in the trenches experience in, you know, the volunteer fire service in New York, but he also has that experience in the industrial world, you know, bringing to the table some architectural components, and he's very famous for, you know, the work he's doing on building construction and those type of venues. He's highly regarded across the United States when it comes to instruction. The second vice president for the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, He has the radio podcast of Taking It to the Streets on Firefighter Netcast. He has buildingsonfire.com. And, of course, he hosts, and I co-host with him, thecompanyofficer.com. Moving right along to our good friend out in the Marion, Kansas Fire Department is Rick Mosier, a lieutenant, bringing me 14 years of service to the table. The last 13 has been with that current department, fire lieutenant in the suppression division, riding on a truck company. He brings a lot to the table when it comes to the education. You know, he's with the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, with the Kansas group. He's also with the Fools, the Wheat State Fools, bringing a lot to the table when it comes to hardcore, down to the basic tactics that we've got to do every day. And, of course, my last but not least, a colleague on the Southeast Association of Fire Chiefs Board is Darren, a.k.a. Pat Wilson, assistant chief down at Johns Creek. He's got plenty of time in the fire service as well, 25 years, 4 years with the Georgia Fire Academy, 10 years over in Fulton County, Georgia. He was also the chief of training with the Sandy Springs Fire Department, a master's degree in business administration. And lo and behold, we've got another doctorate in the berth here, working on his doctoral in fire service leadership. Involved as the Georgia State president and representative for the Southeast Association of Fire Chiefs, also involved in the Standards and Training Council there in Georgia and the Fire Academy Advisory Council. So we want to invite our listeners that if you've got a question, be sure to email us at radiofirehouse.com. So we invite you now to sit back, relax, grab a cup of coffee or a cold drink, pull a chair up or the tailboard up, sit back and enjoy the program. So let's get started. Welcome on board, guys.
Thanks for the invite.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Doug.
Pleasure
This is just a fabulous opportunity. I'm so excited having you guys on board. We're going to dive right in. Dave, I've just got to ask you, the world's changed since when I first met you some 25 years ago in the business. A lot is still the same, but a lot has changed. So let's talk about what's changing in the environment and how do we know it's changing? What do we see that tells us that it changes?
Well, Doug, I think you nailed it. There are changes underfoot, and I think we're actually at a crossroads as it relates to our firefighters out in the trenches and what they see on arrival and what fire behavior within a given home or apartment or business is actually doing. Part of the problem is we are still teaching fire behavior at an overly simple way. What we've discovered with modern fire behavior is frankly causing people to rewrite chemistry books. That's the kind of behavior we're seeing in buildings. Now, the good work that the National Institute of Standards and Technology is doing, NIST, the findings that they're coming out, are basically going to cause us to rewrite fire behavior, that's structural fire behavior as we know it. And that crossroads kind of presents itself that we are perhaps having less fires across the country, at least statistically that's accurate, and we're not experiencing at every level these amazingly hostile fire events within buildings. So that crossroads gives us a challenge, and the challenge is basically to rethink and reassess what we find when we arrive on arrival. And it's probably no more important for first due than it is anybody else. That first due company officer, that first due decision maker, that the first person from the fire department to get a look at smoke leaving a building that's on fire is without a doubt the most critical component or key element in predicting what that fire is going to do next. Now, your ability to predict what a fire is going to do next, once again, comes down to what we've seen in fire behavior in previous years, coupled with what NIST is telling us and what we're unfortunately discovering anecdotally with firefighter fatalities and flashover entrapments, is we have to change our basic understanding. A perfect example of that is a conversation I had with Dan Majikowski from NIST. I asked him point blank, I mean, right to his face, standing shoulder to shoulder at FDIC. I said, Dan, do we need to reteach building fire behavior? He said, absolutely. It's probably our number one challenge in the fire service is to teach fire officer level, our lieutenants, our captains, our first arriving decision makers, how to recognize that a fire doesn't necessarily go through four simple stages anymore. A fire can go through a multitude of stages. For example, most of us have been taught that a fire goes from ignition phase to a growth to a fully developed and a decay phase. That oversimplification is leading to misunderstanding of what a fire is actually going to do inside the building. We would like to, and I say we because it came right from Dan, and I agree wholeheartedly, we'd like to interject two phases into that understanding. One is the vent-restricted phase, which is basically choking down the fire due to the smoke development that's happening with all these low-mass synthetics. And the second is the explosive growth phase. And that happens when something in the building fails or, frankly, firefighters open doors or indiscriminately break windows, and we take a vent-restricted fire, give it a sudden rush of air, and then it develops explosively that all the smoke in the building ignites. So those two phases and the recognition of those two phases are becoming one of the most important elements that we need to teach first two officers. Well, the recognition of that is born in reading smoke. And I think that's why the program that we take around the country is becoming popular, because I think people have seen just enough of this unbelievably explosive behavior. They want to recognize it before it actually happens to them, right? And given an environment where we do have less structure fires, about the only way we can present that and teach people about it and recognize it is through actual raw fire ground footage showing them the smoke characteristics on their arrival so that they can make better go-no-go decisions and, frankly, tailing into the rest of your conversation here, make better tactical choices for their first evolution, for their first engagement with the building that's on fire.
You hit a couple things on the head that are really key, is that there's multiple stages of this growth. And I've personally seen this on responses over the years, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, that you start your size up and what you see in a minute or so later is completely, you know, just against every fire behavior principle that's taught in the textbooks. It just doesn't match. The growth is just exponential. I know in talking to Rick in real recent periods here, they ran a fairly significant response not too awful long ago. Being the first new truck company, Rick, kind of fill us in on the things that you're seeing from, you know, that right-hand seat, riding in as a company officer, and how important it is, as Dave was talking about, in the philosophies of how you're beginning to do decisions and things that you're definitely seeing out there in the field.
Well, you know, there were some really great points made there. What we're seeing out in the field, you know, just about 3 weeks ago, we actually had a fire in a large country club, and we had a hostile fire event on the second floor, probably within the first 4 minutes of the fire. And, you know, it's a rapidly changing environment, and it really takes a key, you know, when we arrive on scene, that we do a thorough size up of the building and understand that, you know, even if we have smoke showing, we've got to go back to those reading smoke tactics of determining, you know, how fast is the smoke moving, and where is it coming from? Where do we think the seat of the fire is? Because what we found, you know, and especially in that event, is when the first engine companies made entry onto the second floor, they were encountered with a fireball that knocked them down and knocked them down the hallway. And, you know, it was just a real big hostile fire event. And in the Kansas City Metro within the last month, the Kansas City Fire Department has had two hostile fire events where first two engine companies, bread and butter fire, truck company goes to vent the roof. And as they're making entry into the building, you know, it flashes or some type of event occurs and knocks them back out of the building. And luckily, in all three instances, nobody was seriously injured. But it's just one of those things is when you arrive on scene, you've got to do a thorough size-up of the building itself. And, you know, look at things like life safety. You know, is the building occupied? And, you know, what time of day it is? And determine, you know, how aggressive of a fire attack can we make here? And can we still keep it safe? And I think one of the big keys, especially for the truck companies, is getting some ventilation started early and giving that fire and that smoke a route to go so that the suppression companies, the engines, can make a quicker fire attack.
Well, you bring that up, and of course, Chris, I'm coming to you right now with this because when we talk about combat fire engagement, wow, some of the changes, and Dave hit on this, Rick's hit on it with these hostile fire events, you know, the need for ventilation, but our buildings have changed. The dynamics of fire have changed. When we ventilate, we're seeing effects that are going right back to exactly what Dave said, and we're creating hostile fire events even with ventilation. So let's talk about these combat fire engagement, the new rules that we need to be thinking about.
Well, so far, you know, we've hit upon an exceptional level of commentary on some very unique threads that, for the most part, the American Fire Service has yet to fully embrace or even has yet to fully identify. I mean, certainly all of us are talking to the choir here. We're all talking about concepts that are drawn out of scientific data, emerging theories and information, but getting it into the mainstream fire service has been a slow and tedious process, certainly over the last 24 months in particular. And a lot of this has come about as a direct result of NIST and Underwriters Laboratory. And again, the data that's finally hitting the street and is starting to resonate, at least in some circles, to the fact that, yes, our buildings have changed. I think we're recognizing or have recognized that. But now we're starting to tie in the data that's coming about as a result of the testing code, because now it's not so much what Dave Dotson is saying or what Chris Naum is saying or any one of the instructors that are out there preaching some of this new theory. It's data that's coming, then it's based upon scientifically proven, replicated information from a variety of different tests that are showing us that fire behavior, the combination of the fire load packages, combination of the building, configuration, size, square footages, all as well as all the other components that go into our occupancies are creating an entirely unique set of parameters that have always been there to some degree, but are changing dramatically due to the kinds of things that we have currently. And it goes back to some very common theories when we talk about just even ventilation. You know, we have a phenomena that is becoming a little bit more readily identifiable, and that's a phenomena called ventilation-induced flashover, that based upon the way our tactics have been derived and implemented, and these conditions that were occurring unbeknownst to us over the last maybe 5 to 8 to 10 years, going back to the early part of this last decade, where we were seeing an increased number of flashover conditions occurring, and again, as a result of those flashovers, increased firefighter injuries and certainly contributing toward some of the line of duty deaths. But we never recognized or could correlate why we were having so many more flashover conditions occurring during the initial combat engagement phases, upon initial entry, or during the first few minutes of suppression activities. And again, through the results of some of the studies that have come about, the theory behind ventilation-induced flashover, where we are actually causing or contributing toward the flashover of these interior compartment conditions during the course of our fire operation. So there's a lot to be said about what's occurring and where we're going, and all that revolves directly around all of the things that we've said so far. One interesting note before I pass it back over to you, Doug, is the most recent information that's just sort of hitting the streets here over the last few days comes about from Underwriters Laboratory, and this deals, again, directly in the impact dealing with ventilation and fire behavior. UL has just recently published some of their perspectives and data based upon their most recent studies dealing with the ventilation on the legacy and contemporary residential structures. And, again, looking at construction, looking at the various types of replicatable conditions dealing with ventilation in the residential type setting with a different type of configuration, both in terms of square footages as well as volume as well as the fire load packages that are in there. There's some very unique information that's coming about that's drawing us directly toward the new focal point on tactical considerations dealing with the stage of fire growth, ventilation profiling, accessing, all of the things that we are just starting to hit upon. So the stuff's out there, but we're just not realizing that the rules of fire engagement are going to change. And it goes back to what Dave mentioned earlier, that we're not teaching the right stuff yet, or the stuff that we are trying to teach or promote. The resistance level in the fire service is so pronounced that it's just not resonating yet with the right groups. But ever so little, we're making some headway into all of these related areas.
Of course, Chief Wilson, I'm coming to you. Pat, you sit in this capacity of where you've got to make some pretty hardcore decisions, not only from a training perspective, but also when you sit as an incident commander and responding to these type of fires. And, of course, what's it like? What are you seeing? I mean, what can you add to this conversation here of the thoughts, the processes of what's going on when you're responding, knowing that you're in charge? And when I say that you're in charge, you've got the life of an entire group of people that are engaged in fire combat right in the palm of your hand. So let's hear what you've got to think about what we're talking about here, this new change, the dynamics that are going on, and all the stuff that's been brought to the table thus far.
Well, Doug, I can tell you, you know, from my end, you asked that question, what do I think or how do I feel? Sometimes I get scared. I tell you, you know, you arrive at these structures, and I what I see with a lot of our young officers today, they missed out on some things. They've not had maybe some of the training and some of the things that we were just talking about. Some of them are just getting introduced to this. And no doubt, when they arrive, they're taking the old tactics or the things that they were taught years ago and trying to apply it to a totally different monster today. And from my end, it is very scary. I think back in the summer, I had a working house fire. It was an attic fire in a very large, it was a residential structure, but, you know, this thing is, you know, 3,000, 4,000 square feet and an attic space that you can live in. And this, our guys are there working, and, you know, for me, you say about having the lives in your hands, no doubt. I was very nervous. I'm walking around this house, and I take a look at a couple of things I didn't like. I had fire venting out of a couple of openings in the roof, and I got crews operating. And then all of a sudden, I hear a key word. One of my guys says he's, you know, experiencing a lot of heat. And I said, you know, we have to do something different here. We're not getting where we need to be. And I think that at the end of the day, I ended up pulling these guys out of this house. The mentality is, Chief, why did you do this? Why did you pull us out? We had it. And, you know, for me, I have to look at the lives of our firefighters and, you know, what the risk is that's involved in knowing that fire behavior is not what it was years ago. In other words, it's totally changing. You know, when we arrive, and like I said, that smoke showing, this thing can change so quickly. I think back to a young firefighter in Fulton County, Felix Roberts, that was killed in 2007. A bread and butter operation. They arrive, have people trapped in the house. They make entry, making headway. All of a sudden, conditions change rapidly. Ends up, they had fire in the basement. Fire had extended into the attic space. They had a rapid failure at some point, and at the end of the night, we had a firefighter that was dead, a fire officer, a captain that was severely injured in this fire. And I think that we definitely have to change the mindset of our fire officers as they arrive. And I think probably the key to that is early development, early training for our officers. And then for the officers that are currently in place, we have to really put them in situations and give them more practical application of understanding the new technology that's out there. You know, I send stuff out probably on a, I won't say a daily basis, but every few days I'm finding a new article and I'm sending it to these guys and we discuss it, but I don't know if they really are taking that stuff in. And I think it's really going to be a mindset change that we have to get with our company officers. And I also say we have to do that with our incident commanders, because we sometimes get on scene and we get lulled into things are okay. I know I have a lieutenant or a captain that's in there and I know they know what's going on, and I really don't know if we really have that as it relates to our good strong tactics and strategies when we pull up on this new house, on this new structure that we're fighting fire in.
Well, you know, if you think about this increased awareness that we're going to have, there's a bottom line here. We've got to increase our awareness. We've got to bring some real-world experience, and the only way that we're getting real-world experience is the sharing of these, and I'm going to call them near misses. Anytime we have a hostile fire event and it's not being reported, we're not sharing this information, we're not, you know, delegating it out to everyone in the fire service to have this vicarious learning, then we're missing something. Because if we don't fully understand how that building is performing, and definitely how it's going to react under fire conditions and all the variables that are going to influence its stability and how it degrades and how the fire is going to move and behave, how the products of combustion is going to impact that, then we're going to be lost. But we also have to bring, you know, into consideration, we don't have a lot of information. A lot of this is coming, you know, just down to us. It's beginning to come out in this research with NIST and UL. And, you know, all the materials that we're gathering, you know, it's beginning to occur currently in our world. So, Dave, how do we go about recognizing and getting this true understanding of what's going on in that building? Because we know that the dynamics of fire behavior have changed because of the building construction. So how do we read that? How do we know what we're getting ourselves into, and how do we become more what I'm going to call situational awareness familiar with what's happening when we pull up?
There's probably a multifaceted approach we can take to this, and we almost have to look at the different levels of learning that take place all over the country. It starts at the academy level. We have to continue our work with the major publishers, with this standards making process, and make sure that the reference text that we send people to learn and study from, reflect what this new environment is. It's almost like we have to rethink the way we're teaching fire behavior. We have to add the two phases of fire, because that's the one that's getting us sucker punched, is that vent-restricted phase and that explosive growth phase. We have to make sure that that is being taught at the basic level. Now, that starts with our instructors. Our instructors, even if their textbook that they're using doesn't have it, they have to jump on board right away and make sure that that message is getting out. It's almost like we're at that crossroads where the instructor has to say, here's what your manual said. Here's what your homework said. This is what we're going to test you on, state certification. But we do have an evolving reality out there that we need to address right now, right here, because it's going to affect you on your first shift. That's one effort. The second big effort has to be at our company officer level. And it doesn't matter if it's a brand new young company officer or that 30-year veteran that's pretty set in their ways and has been using a system that works very well for them. That's going to be one of our toughest audiences to address. Hopefully that's what we're doing with FDIC, with Fire Expo or Fire World, all these different seminars going on, because that's their target market, is to get those people in a seat and teach them about this. The near-miss stuff, the firefighters' close calls that the Billy Goldfeder's got out, that's reaching, I heard somewhere, 200,000 people anytime Billy sends a blast out on firefighterclosecalls.com through the secret list. We're trying to work at that level. Then comes our chief officer level, our line officers, our battalion chiefs, district chiefs, that sort of thing. They need to have that recognition also. Once again, it's a tough customer because they are so busy doing our day-to-day politics, our day-to-day paperwork and stuff like that, that this critical event could get lost in their radar screen. So we have to keep in their face there. So that's our learning systems that we've got to keep addressing, keep our efforts out there, keep supporting the work of NIST and ISFSI and their training packages that they're throwing out and that sort of thing, and keep on that. We cannot let our energy level go down there, because that's going to be putting at the root of the issue. As far as what can a guy listening to this program take from this, it really comes down to this. It's situational awareness. It's the time that you spend and invest in understanding the situation. We like to say size up. Gosh, I'm at the point now that I want to take the word size up and blow it up and get rid of it and change the basic way we teach that. Every size up means so many different things to so many people, and we have so many different models out there that I think it's kind of gotten lost. I prefer using the phrase situational awareness, which we know our military leaders, our combat pilots, even in the law enforcement, everything's switching to the whole concept of situational awareness. You have to invest the time to become aware. And at a simple structure fire at 2 o'clock in the morning for the first due company officer, that situational awareness comes down to their ability to read the smoke coming out of that building, to read the building itself, and to read the risk. Now, when we get to the risk, emotions get involved, because all of us have been pretty much hammered that life safety is our number one thing, and we emotionally give life safety every possible opportunity. And that's good, it's moral, it's driven the fire service, it's endeared us to our communities, but we have to have a frank discussion about survivability and survivability index. And we have to be willing to make a judgment before engagement about survivability within given spaces of a building. So even something like time of day probably doesn't mean as much as it once did in our complex lives. It's more important to invest the time and do that walk around, or that three sides or four sides if you can get it done, and really become aware of the fire conditions within that building, the survivable spaces within that building, and how is the building going to react to all of those things.
You brought up a good piece about the life safety and that frank discussion. A lot of research is now telling us that in the very early stages of fire, and I know when I did a study with Tempest and looking at just CO levels inside of a building when we were working with positive pressure operations and looking at how we can reduce the amount of CO, trying to create survivable environments for victims, we saw very early that our CO2 levels had rose, you know, far beyond what anybody could live. Even if we pulled them out, took them right to the hyperbaric chamber, decompressed them, the survivability would not be there. And I even confirmed this when I began looking at this with doctors from Duke University and also from the Burn Center at the University of North Carolina's hospital, and especially with Dr. Peck. But he also threw out there something that the research is beginning to show and has become prevalent, especially over the last 3 or 4 years. And I know here in High Point, we're even have monitors to be able to do hydrogen cyanide simply because of the products that are burning and the survivability. Knowing that hydrogen cyanide is a cellular asphyxiant, and that, you know, most EMS units, being a paramedic and working within the system, we know that most EMS units aren't even carrying hydrogen cyanide antidote kits. And you get to the ER, most of the time they got to call the pharmacy to get it. You know, the time period that's lapsed there is probably fatal. And we're beginning to see that the anoxia levels are so high that there's, you know, even if they do survive, there's brain damage. So let's talk about this environment. Rick, I'm going to come to you because you're crawling hallways still. You're still making those entries. You're still doing search and rescue. And I know you got to make those critical decisions. And, you know, from the perspective, you know, how do you make that decision? What determines to you whether it's survivable or not?
Well, you know, there's been some really, really great points made. Because it isn't, you know, this isn't our father's or grandfather's building anymore, even though on the exterior, you know, when you pull up, especially like in my city, where we've got older homes, you know, it's a first-ring suburb. So we've got older houses, but you got to think of what the people have put inside those, you know, the synthetics and things like we've talked about so far in our conversation. So is riding in the right seat when you pull up, you do have to be very situationally aware. And, you know, it's some of the basics, you know, the tried and true is you check with the neighbors, you make sure, you know, hey, what's going on here. But at the same time, you know, you really have to pay attention to that smoke. You have to do a good 360 of the building itself, you know, and think about, you know, where could this fire be? Use some of those tried and true methods that when you're doing your 360, if you feel your body get warm, you probably know you have it in the back bedroom. But you have to think about that and do a complete, thorough assessment of the building and not have that, you know, the attitude that we might have had 6, 5, 4 years ago of just get off the rig, drag a hose, ladder the roof, and immediately go to work. You have to kind of take a step back and kind of assess the full big picture there. And sometimes I think, you know, to the public, when they look at us, they're like, well, it's taken you guys a little while to get things moving towards putting the fire out. But at the same time, you want to make sure that everybody goes home safe. And I know in my experience in the last few fires that we've had, there have been rapid fire changes. And it's really made me sit back and really try and reflect on, you know, what can we do differently to make this a safer environment and to make sure that all the guys go home. And I think it's just being situationally aware and paying attention to your smoke, paying attention to if you have any fire. One of the big things that played in our last fire was wind. You know, we've heard a lot about wind-driven fires, and you really got to think about where's your wind coming from, and if something does vent before we vent it, you know, is that going to increase the fire? You know, is it going to fan the fire for us inside? And, you know, one of the other tactical considerations now that I think, you know, there's so many different options out there with different foam agents. And, you know, if you're not able to have that, you got to take GPM with you. You got to have gallons per minute. Gallons per minute helps us to be safer. Might not completely extinguish the fire, but at least it helps us to be safer. And so those are just some of the components that I think you have to look at before you make an interior fire attack nowadays. And it's not always a popular decision. And especially when the armchair quarterbacks are watching the evening news, you know, they sometimes like to come out and say that you're not being as aggressive as you should be, but you got to keep the guys safe. And it is a drastically changing environment out there.
Well, bringing that into perspective, of course, it is. It's definitely changing. But, you know, Chris, I'm coming to you with this. What do we know about the structures that are in districts? What do we know about structures today and when they're under fire conditions? I know we still have the old buildings. We can go back to the godfather of building construction, Francis Brannigan. We can talk about anywhere from Type 1 to Type 5. And, of course, before Frank died, when we were working on a lot of the rapid intervention stuff, he said there's really a Type 6, and that's when you combine any and all of these together. So what do we know about our structures when we get them under the degradation of fire?
Well, I think, Doug, one of the clear distinctions or the changes when we talk about buildings and occupancies is the fact that we no longer need to start looking at buildings from an occupancy type standpoint, but start looking at our occupancies from a risk standpoint. So it's occupancy risk versus occupancy type. That and foremost would start getting us on the right train of thought in terms of looking at our occupancies and profiling them based upon predictability predictability of performance. In other words, I can take, and again, a great point was just made. I mean, when we talk about our older structures, we predicate or we predict that there's certain expectations that fire is going to travel in a definable or predictable manner, that fire will hold within a room or compartment for a predictable given duration of time, that the fire load and related fire flows that are going to be required are going to be appropriate for an expected size and maybe a severity of the fire that we encounter, again, in a given building, in a given occupancy, based upon a certain structural system, based upon our training, skills, and what we've done through past evolutions and operations. We've typically handled those things in a fairly predictable and safe, repetitive fashion. But again, these past operational experiences in our building types, both favorable and negative, have given us what we predetermine how fast we're going to enter the building, how quickly we think we're going to be able to mobilize and move through the structure, and how that fire condition is going to either work for us or against us as we get into our fire engagement. But when it all boils down, we're looking at buildings, both legacy or historical type structures that were built in years past, as well as the most current generation of structures. And especially when we talk about engineered system and conventional construction, volume sizes, the engineered systems, the manner in which these buildings and the compartments are being built, coupled with the fire load packages that we're putting in these buildings, have created entirely different sets of operational parameters that we are not fully realizing when we talk about building construction and firefighting. It's truly evolving when we talk about the theory of fire suppression and what I usually term to be the art and science of firefighting and its relationship on the anatomy of buildings. I've always been a true advocate that, you know, we've got to understand and be able to pick up on a lot of the key indicators on number one, how to read a building, and then secondly, looking at the predictability of performance based upon the new sets of rules of engagement that we're talking about here on this program, and then taking a look at that predictability of performance and understanding what and how we're going to interface and when we're going to interface in that operations. And the one clear message that sort of ties all of this together is what I call tactical patience. Slowing down enough when we get into our tactical mode of operation to initiate the 360, to initiate effective dynamic assessment, looking at incident indicators that are going to be there in the building, whether it be the smoke, whether it be trying to identify the potential structural system and makeup of the building, at least identifying, processing, and assessing what the size of that structure in terms of the volume, the fire growth and its travel, the severity, the magnitude, how all of these things are going to come together before I actually stretch that line and put a deployment inside that threshold of that first door, or put guys up onto the roof, or initiate any of the other tactical task assignments. So it's a very dynamic set of parameters that we now have to start not only teaching, but having the fire service start recognizing that we're not dealing with the same types of theories of fire suppression and firefighting as we did even as early as 10 years ago. That's how dramatically the changes have come about, even in the older structures, let alone our discussions that we could start getting into on our newer, both commercial and residential and multiple family occupancies.
Well, bringing all this to the table is definitely going to be important. One of the things that I've heard is, you know, the tactical patience. We've got to slow up. We got to make better decisions. We got to make what I will call more informed decisions. And that goes back to what Dave said with the situational awareness, truly having an understanding, truly seeing. So, Pat, I'm going to come to you with this. And when we think about it, how do you begin getting the setup going from a command perspective? And I'm gonna slide you into a little bit of your training role now. How do you get people to begin changing how they've done operations for years and recognize that we need to deploy in a completely different way? We need to, you know, deploy our tactics differently. We need to have different mindsets in our operations. And one of the key components that Rick brought out was the GPMs. We've got to have enough GPMs or enough extinguishing agent to be able to overcome BTUs if we're going to go that route. So I'm going to turn it over to you and let you go ahead.
Okay, Doug, and, you know, you say that. No doubt, you know, it's very difficult when you have firefighters who have learned one way or the other and trying to convince them or trying to get them to see things in a different light. And that's very difficult. And I know that's a challenge that I face daily with our folks here and other places and trying to get that across in a way that they truly understand and really believe in the new concepts. I really think it starts early with our firefighters. You know, I want to go back to one thing with involving what I call reevaluating or redefining the basics of firefighting. I think this has been touched on earlier. We got to start there. We really have to look at what we have been teaching and what we need to be teaching our firefighters from day one. I think that we have become very trapped into a system of, I kind of call it robotic firefighters, do these steps and do this step and do this step and pass this test, and you're a firefighter. And then it kind of ends there. And then this person goes into the field, and they have that veteran person say, well, hey, you go with me, you got to do this, and we're gonna get there, and we're going to get it done. We're going to be tough, and we're going to burn our helmets up and our gear up. And that mindset sometimes gets ingrained in our young firefighters, and it just goes on and on and on and on. And then they become our future officers, and then they become our future chief officers. And then all of a sudden, we have this change that we have today and that we've had over the last, like you said, 10 years. And to get these people to understand, our firefighters today, to truly understand this, is somewhat of a challenge. So I think first we have to start with our basics and really redefining what we're teaching our firefighters from day one. And then I think another component of this is fire officer development, and we have to start that early before we promote somebody to the lieutenant or the captain or the battalion chief or even fire chief. That we really have to get them in a position where they're going to be successful. I think back, I was looking at an article yesterday in reference to the Charleston fire. Some of the things I read there, had they seen some of the things that we're looking at today and maybe some mindset changes, we maybe would have prevented that tragedy there in Charleston. You know, for me, I think really aggressively hitting our company officers is key right now. You know, in my department, you know, we have really worked hard on developing a officer development program for our existing officers. I mentioned this earlier. Practical application. I think we have to put them in situations where they have to practice making those decisions, and then when they make poor decisions in a training environment, allow them, give us time to be able to work with these people and point this out. I think, unfortunately, for firefighters, you know, we are sometimes hard-headed, and we only learn it when something really, really, really bad happens. And you know, Lord knows I don't want that to happen. I think that we have to work hard, and we have to just continuously put this in their face. We have to make those tough decisions on the fire ground. Again, I think back to the fire I was on this summer where we pulled crews out. I was criticized, I'll be quite honest with you, or at least, you know, the grumblings in the background of, Chief, why'd you pull us out? And I had one firefighter come to me the day after the fire, and he came to me and said, hey, Chief, I do appreciate what you did. I appreciate what you did last night. And you thought about my family. And I said, what do you mean? He says, you pulled us out of that environment, and that thing was going to go to the bad. It eventually did. However, we were able to bring it under control. But the situation was reading way bad. And getting our guys to truly understand and really step back and see that big picture, see what's happening inside that structure, see that it's so easy to get caught up in the heat of the moment that we truly overlook those obvious things that can be ready to bite us in the rear end so quickly. I think we just have to continue to preach this. We practice this in our training. You know, the fire service has changed so much that, you know, we're so involved with so many different aspects of our communities. And I know for our department, which is I'm very, very proud to be a part of a great community. We're out here, we're talking, we're dealing and doing all kind of cool things for our community. However, I think we are not taking full advantage of every moment that we can to talk about these things. You know, we again, I can send out an article, but I don't know if every day or if all of our folks read those articles like they should, and then really take the information that's been passed on to them through the articles and through the things we find through NIST or through UL. And I don't know if they believe it or not, and that is the challenge that I face. I think that all training officers and training chiefs or anybody that's involved with training face today is really being able to come up with a good program that brings it to them in a way and really gets them to open their eyes, get our folks to open their eyes.
Well, you're definitely bringing a lot, and training is going to be the key in getting all this information out and making sure that we have exactly what we need out on the table. It's just
absolutely, Doug. I think that one of the things we miss in some of the fire stations. I won't say this is for every department, and I think our guys in Johns Creek for sure they're definitely doing a lot of training. But I think we have to reevaluate what we're training on and getting to that point of really having frank discussions, just like we're having tonight, on what's out there and what can get us in, and really making and helping our folks to understand that.
Well, that's a very good point. Well, folks, we're up to a break. You're listening to Training and Tactics Talk, real issues, real training, and real solutions, focusing on our number one priority, and that's everyone goes home. We'll be back right after this break.
Firehouse World 2011 is the largest fire service event west of the Mississippi and takes place in San Diego, California, February 26th through March 2nd. Register today at firehouseworld.com and be part of the action. You will have access to over 100 training and educational sessions, 350 exhibitors, plus network with over 7,500 firefighters from around the country. This is one event you don't want to miss.
Well, welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, and joining me is retired battalion chief and instructor, Dave Dotson, the chief of training at the Command Institute, Christopher Nam, assistant chief down in Johns Creek, Georgia, Darren Wilson, and Lieutenant Rick Mosier from out in Kansas. And we want to remind our listeners that if you have any questions or comments or you would like to hear a topic on training and tactics, to email us in at podcast@firehouse.com. And in the first half of our show, we really dug down into what are the issues or what are some of the issues that exist in today's fire service, from the changes in fire behaviors to the changes in building construction, the dynamics, the need to have this true situational awareness. On the second part of our show, we're going to really dive in, and let's just kick it off, and I'm going to open this up to the group. Let's talk about what we know from past experiences. We've got history that's repeated itself several times. We can go from wall bombs to Hackensack. We can add Worcester in there. We can add, you know, the incidents in Virginia. We can go to Iowa. We can go to Pittsburgh. We have a lot of things that are happening, and we're seeing a lot of information that's coming out. Let's talk about those situations and how they're impacting how we're thinking today, because there is a lot of similarities, but yet there's a lot of differences. And what do we know on this? What's the information that's out there? So I'm going to open it up to you guys.
Well, I think a good starting place is just the basic concept that today's structure fire, you know, we say is not your grandfather's fire. Hell, we should be saying today's structure fire is not your big brother's fire. That's how radical things have changed. And our rate of experience in all those incidents you talked about, Doug, we learn lessons from those, but I don't think it's turned the whole corner for the fire service in general. Now, don't get me wrong. There's some pockets of excellence going on out there, and the way people process and the way they engage the structural fire environment, and those processes are starting to pay dividends. We're getting a lot of successes in. But I would say that's just a small fraction of the whole fire service. We've got to turn the big truck around, if you will. We do learn from all those incidents. Some people call it vicarious learning through the mistakes of others, and those certainly are getting logged. But the basic attitude is we do have to treat the next fire not like the one you just had. We have to be more situationally aware, as we've said numerous times already with our time together, and think forward. And I guess I'm not so stuck and enamored with thinking from the past. We learn from the past, but we have to think for the next incident. And what I did 2 months ago at a structure fire may not have been the best solution. We have to learn and keep moving forward and think about the next incident and be on our game and treat it for what it's presenting, not what a previous fire presented. That's the kind of rate of change we're talking about here. So,
well, you're not wrong at all. And, you know, when you think about it and we throw in, you know, that Chris, I'm going to throw this to you, and I'm going to preface this with a statement here, because I know we've had this dialogue several times, and, you know, when we go at it, the changes are so great. I mean, they're very fast. We know, as David said, it's our big brother's fire. It's not even close to that anymore. But when we think of this, let me hear your thoughts to the side of what's changing and how do we handle this change?
Well, I think we're all recognizing that the fire service is changing just in terms of the conversations that are occurring on the floors at the conferences, at FDIC, at Fire Rescue, at Firehouse. I mean, all of the different programs and conferences, as well as the dialogue that's occurring and the buzz that's on the Internet, whether it be on the various home sites of the publications or on the various blogs and so forth. There's a buzz that's occurring, and it all sort of resonates around the common direction that I think we're finally going towards, and that's towards firefighter safety. You take a look at the initiatives of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, the Everyone Goes Home campaign and programs. I mean, I think they have done a tremendous job of at least starting to gel some concepts, and those concepts are all about firefighter safety, all about line of duty death reduction, injury reduction, the everyone goes home concept. And out of those offshoots are all of the elements that we're starting to talk about, the new rules of engagement, different philosophies and perspectives on fire ground operations and on our methodologies and so forth. But it all goes back to the essence of where and what we do our job at, and that's the building. And certainly when we talk about those changes, you know, where we've recognized back in the mid-70s, early 1980s, we started talking about lightweight construction. And just in terms of the fact that we had some changes that were occurring rather dramatically due to the construction and outgrowth in most of our suburban communities around the country, and we started seeing different construction, and we started focusing in on truss construction at that time and predominantly on roof systems, and that evolved from roof systems now to the floor systems, and now here we are in 2010 going into 2011, and we're talking about engineered structural systems. We're talking about building components that are entirely different in terms of the physics, in terms of the architecture and the engineering, and now we take into that account all of the emerging data that's coming out of NIST and UL in particular, that start looking at fire behavior, fire loading, and how all of these theories and practices that were born on the physics and the methodologies of firefighting, the rules are changing. The rules have changed. They're not even, you know, past tense, but they have changed, but we as a fire service have not recognized them and have not been able to start implementing them in the short duration time frame. In other words, let's go look at the training component part of it. You know, we're waiting for the books to catch up, and we've got this steep learning curve or time frame in which our textbooks and all of the documents that we utilize in our training academies and our training schools and our fire department organizations to educate the recruits, to educate the probationary firefighters, to educate our company officers are lagging behind. So the biggest thing that we've got to do is get out in front of everybody with this information, make them aware of it, and start implementing it into our local level strategic and tactical incident action plans or methodologies and start looking at it from a pragmatic, holistic standpoint and not wait for suddenly this you know, great speaker to suddenly come about or manifest themselves at some conference and say, this is what you got to do, and this is why you got to do it. Maybe you don't even have to realize why you're doing it, but as soon as the right person says it, and it's going to be suddenly like that that fuse that gets lit. But, you know, we can't wait for that one individual or the right person to come along. All of us have to be championing these types of methodologies and causes and outlooks based upon all of the data that's coming out, based upon our entire career's worth of experience and the kinds of things that we are promoting that's based upon our experiences and based upon the emerging theories, and put it all together and start hitting those buttons and start beating those drums.
Well, I totally agree. Part of what I'm going to bring to the table on this is that as a fire service as a whole, we get caught up in this concept called status quo. We like to maintain, you know, what's presently there. You know, we don't like this change component. You know, but when we do this, we're really becoming very stagnant. And in, Dave alluded to this, that we've, you know, got a lot of stuff that's going on out there with groups of people that are really dynamic and, you know, right up on this. They're on the cutting edge. They're really pushing it. But we also have a huge component in the fire service, or a large group of people that are still fighting fire like we did back in 1979, 1983, you know, 1989, and a lot's changed. And it's the mentality. And what's happened, I believe, is that we've embraced the status quo so much that we've become stagnant. We've stopped developing. We've stopped progressing. We're not advancing. And we've actually got what I will call that sluggish or dull appearance, you know, in our operations, in our training. And what we've got to have and what we've got to bring to the table is definitely some vision-oriented leadership. And we've got to change this attitude. And, of course, that's something that I've wrote, you know, extensively on over the past probably 6 or 8 months. And, you know, attitude may be the only difference between success or failure. And if we have a failure on the fire ground or we have an incident on the fire ground, the best that we can hope for, and Chris, I've heard you say this, and Dave, I've heard you say this, the best that we can hope for is that we only get somebody hurt. And to me, that's not necessarily cutting it. You know, I definitely don't believe in that. So I think we're up to the point that we need to create some change. And that change, if you're going to create change, where does it start? It starts in training. And part of what I believe we've got to do is get this, you know, mindset of where we're beginning to assess, looking at the needs of where we've been, where we are now, and where we really should be. But Dave said it. What fire we fought 2 weeks ago is not going to be what we're going to fight tomorrow. So we've got to be ahead of the game. We've got to be on this proactive approach. We've got to have this efficiency of we know what's coming down the road, and that's definitely there. So, Rick, I'm going to jump over to you. You're on the streets. You're the guy that is the true trainer of the fire service. You're that company officer, and how do you get this done? I know today's schedules are busy. I know that there's a lot of things going on. We've got everything from A to Z in the fire service, and God forbid we have a fire call because it's going to interrupt the schedule. And, you know, how do we fit all this stuff in?
Yeah, that's you know, you made some great points there, and you're right. You know, if the poll's not shined, then we're not doing our job, you know. So, but, you know, I think how do you fit it in? I think you fit it in where best you can, and I think one of the most important things is kind of that tailboard critique, you know, after an incident, because, you know, not all fires are going to be the same anymore, and taking the crews back after that and saying, hey, guys, you know, what was weird about this? What did you notice that's different from a fire that we had before? And kind of doing that tailboard critique after you get the tools cleaned and the rigs back in service. Because generally we got a little bit of time there that we can sit back and it's fresh in everybody's mind and make some notes. I think the other thing is just in your day-to-day training, you know, it seems like in so many fire service departments you get into the pencil whipping or you get into just the mundane, pull out the manual and go through something. But I think you got to look for some creative ways, you know, either pay attention to the firefighter close call. NIST has some great videos out there. And look at some of these different avenues of current material that you can kind of sit down and make a 20 or 30 minute training program out of for the crew that's on duty. I think that'll pay dividends. And once again, you know, the ugly head always rears itself that you're dealing with these tried and true aggressive firefighters that don't want to change, or they have the attitude that they don't want to change. And, you know, the only way that I think we're going to get them to change, you know, it starts at that company level with the officer. If the officer's got that positive attitude and continuously sits down and says, hey, guys, we need to pay attention to this, hopefully at some point some of that attitude will change. Because that's what you deal with a lot of the time, is you deal with the tried and true, well, you know, one size fits all firefighting, and it's not there anymore. You know, it's definitely well beyond that. And I think the other component to it, too, is doing some good pre-fire planning. Getting into some of the commercial buildings, you know, it's you can't really get into residential structures, but at least you can get into the commercial buildings. You can see what's inside of them. You can see the type of construction that it is. You can take some of those tailboard discussions and kind of, you know, do the what-if scenarios. And it's going to give you a good idea. I mean, it's not going to be all-inclusive, but it's at least going to give you a good idea of what you could be thinking about to expect if you had a fire in this environment, and trying to find out the best that you can to residential settings. But you're absolutely right. I mean, in today's company, there's inspections, there's EMS training, there's fire training, there's, you know, alarms. God forbid we have to make alarms with the busy schedule that we have today. So you just kind of got to look for those little, you know, nooks of time to kind of fit all this in. And it takes a lot on the company officers, you know, that puts a lot on their shoulders to try and develop something, to try and take some of the current material out there and make it into something useful for the crews and keep them to have a positive, open attitude to go, hey, this is something we need to pay attention to.
You know, I think you nailed it right there. The company officer has to be willing to do that. And I use the concept called loitering. Basically, we are in residential properties more than we've ever been, given the medical caseload that so many of our fire departments have. There's an opportunity there to loiter a little bit, maybe not right there where you're doing patient care, but when you're cleaning up the mess after the wagons hauled off the victim, that kind of stuff, that is an opportunity to just look around. And when you get back on that apparatus headed back to the station, you talk about it. It's right there. Did you guys see the fire load in that building? You know what that would create for us? Or did you see that layout of that building? Or did you see the incredible volume inside that building and how much smoke it would hold before we could see anything on the outside? It's those kind of conversations. It's keeping in the face. You know, sometimes we have to, you know, meet our measurables, so many inspections a month, so many whatever a month. But every single one of those is an opportunity to bring it back full circle and say, hey, did you guys see this? Now let's talk about that just a little bit. And that can be on your way to the grocery store to pick up the day's meal, or when you get back to the station before you let everybody go back to the home in a volunteer. You have that captured audience just for a minute to say, hey, did you guys see this? It's not in the context of the incident we just went to, like an odor investigation or a fire alarm reset or whatever, but you can talk about what if. And it's putting that conversation forward at every opportunity is one of our paths to change. But that comes right from the company officer. And the more information we can give that company officer to share with their crew, the better off we're going to be.
I did something a few years ago, Dave, and it was right on that same line. You know, I learned very early as a company officer that you take advantage of every opportunity. And when we rode through a district, when we were returning from a call, a lot of what we did was train. And we took advantage of that time to train in so many different facets and so many different ways of looking at the similarities of buildings, the potential for similarities and layouts of, you know, if we were just in that, you know, residential structure in that, you know, neighborhood, that everything is somewhat similar. of looking, okay, if we have a fire in here, this is what we're up against. These are some of the challenges, and you hit on that. But we also went to the degree of when we were in an area of recognizing and doing a mental map of these, you know, houses have cars that are there consistently. We see people out in the yards during the day. So we know that if we respond in there at 1:30 in the afternoon that there's a mom and three kids. You know, we went to that level of what I call the pre-incident analysis and truly performing risk assessments when we had them and when we had the opportunity to sit down and really evaluate. So we did just tons and tons of pre-planning. And one that sticks out to my, in my mind that was a case to myself, we were responding in. I was actually on the truck company, and we were rolling in. The engine company called a single-story structure. Well, I had worked that district prior, and I knew that there was nothing in that neighborhood that was a single story. And, of course, across the headset, I'm telling the crew rolling in, I said, look, guys, if they're calling it a single story, they obviously have not got around back. There's a drop-off. There's nothing in here that is a single story. I'm very familiar with the neighborhood. We've got to look at it. It may give you that appearance. There could be an upstairs that is somewhat, you know, out of the cathedral level that just gives the appearance of a large roof, but it's actually living space with no windows. You know, I've been in this neighborhood. I know we've got to be careful rolling in. You know, we got to be thinking about, you know, the ventilation, watching where the drop-offs could be. You know, there could be a, you know, a fairly high wall, those type of things, and it pays dividends. I mean, it truly pays dividends. And, Pat, I heard you speaking up from a command level. Jump in here, brother.
Well, excuse me. One of the things I was going to say, and just listening to the discussion on the company officers and taking that time to talk with their folks, and I think it's so critical that we really push and try to develop that passion to do that. I think, unfortunately, some places, some departments, people have been put into these positions as company officers or chief officers, and they didn't know what to expect. They thought, you know, they think that a company officer is the cat that comes in and writes you up for not wearing the right shirt or some of the things that are obviously important, but not as important as, you know, keeping ourselves alive on the fire ground. And I think that, you know, we really have to push that. We really have to really encourage our company officers. You know, I tell our guys all the time, I said, you're the most powerful people we have in the fire department. The lieutenants, the captains, and the sergeants, and the company officers and fire departments, they are the most powerful people. They have the most the power to affect more people than anybody else. You know, the chief or assistant chiefs can say, do, holler, scream all day long, but at the end of the day, the company officers have the most power, and we have to empower them. We have to put those tools in their hands, and we have to really motivate them and get them to get that passion about the job again, and to get out here and take that those precious moments when you're doing an inspection. Or I heard Dave say earlier, when you're on the med call and you get back in the apparatus and say, hey, did you see that, or did you notice that about that house or about that structure? Because that is critical. That's where we make a difference, and we have to put those tools in the company officer's hands, and not only encourage, but I almost demand that they get out and do these things. It is so pertinent. If we want to see the change, I think it really, that's one of the areas or one of the places we really have to start, is at the company officer level. How do we affect the 30-year officer that's on the rig? I don't know. We just have to keep pushing. We have to really get them to see. You know, I wrote myself a little note here saying that sometimes we have a short-minded syndrome. When something really bad happens, when an event takes place, when a firefighter loses his life or a firefighter is injured severely, or a group of firefighters, or we're quick to pomp and circumstance, and we have the dress uniforms, and, you know, we know all that stuff, but yet we don't celebrate the good things. We don't know how to we forget so quickly when those bad things happen, and we kind of fall back into that old rut and that easy way of handling things, status quo, as we said earlier. And I think we really have to work to make those changes and to empower the company level officers.
You know, we didn't say a single thing in the last 15 minutes that costs the fire department any more money.
And that's definitely an impact when we're talking about browning out stations, when we're dropping, you know, companies down to ridiculously low numbers of manpower. It's not uncommon today to see a two-person engine company or a two-person truck company. It's affected across the United States. You know, I saw an email, and I don't remember exactly where it was today, but they were talking about, you know, 61 firefighters being laid off because they didn't get a federal grant. I mean, the budgets are impacting. I think what we've got to do, and this is a concept that has been, you know, briefly discussed and thrown out there, you know, our good friend and colleague Billy Goldfeder threw it out, are we going to be an interior department or are we going to be an exterior department? And it's going to be up to the communities to decide exactly what we do. If they're not going to give us the funding and the resources, how can we go interior and be safe?
But, Doug, you know, the fire department is the one that's got to make those decisions. Don't wait for the public. I mean, we have to understand our own limitations. We cannot be operating. If I've got a two-man engine company and I'm working a structural fire alarm, and I'm going to engage in that occupancy, I can't treat that the same way I would be treating it from a tactical or strategic standpoint as I would if I had a five-man engine company and a four-man or four-person ladder truck company. I mean, we've got to understand that we cannot do the same things with the limitations that are being imposed. And we can't do the same things with those limitations, even when they're the favorable limitations based upon the structures and the changes that are occurring. We started talking a little bit about this. You know, we talked about effective fire flows and the right GPM. I mean, man, we're sometimes so underestimating our particular resource needs, both manpower-wise and fire flow-wise, that we shouldn't even be in the buildings to begin with because we're not effectively engaging in a suppression activity. We're just waiting for that fire truly to start burning down to our capacity and capability.
We did a show this past year with Les Stevens on Training and Tactics Talk, and we focused in, just as you're saying, on the requirements of manpower and resources. We took this predominantly to the commercial structure, and we looked at, you know, can you put the GPMs in place to flow? Do you have enough people to do what you're supposed to do? You know, how much of the building is involved? Do we have adequate water supply? You know, can we actually perform the tactics, and is it safe based on building construction? This goes back to our situational awareness. And you're hitting on something here that's important, and it's desperately important, and it definitely falls into situational awareness. So, Dave, I'm going to jump across to you simply because you're the one that talks about really understanding what's going on here, and that's, you know, the art of reading smoke. Let me get your feelings.
Well, I think we're hitting all the way around it, and maybe if there's a take-home to all of this, it does all start with situational awareness. If you can understand the fire behavior that's taking place within that building by watching the smoke, and that's very doable, it's that study of volume, velocity, density, color, and then equate that, or at least in your mind, spatially relate that to the building you're dealing with, you can get a good grasp of what's about to happen. See, so often we make decisions on what we see. What we should be doing is making decisions, tactical decisions and approaches based on what it's going to be by the time we can successfully deploy an evolution. Our aggressiveness should be in tactical accomplishment. Our aggressiveness should not be in tactical choices. But if we can get that SA down, that situational awareness down, and understand what's about to happen, then all we have to do is look at what am I bringing to the party. And in our political, economic, challenged world that so many fire departments are going through right now, there's some cutbacks going. Well, if that's the case, we have to cut back on what we reasonably can get accomplished, just like Chris said. And that's the essence of good decision-making for a first-due company officer. It's like empowering them to make a go, no-go decision based on their situational awareness and what they're bringing to the party, and do the best fit you can. And once you make a tactical decision or a tactical set of priorities, then our aggressiveness is in how you accomplish that tactic. That's where the energy can flow. but we got to make sure it's a sound tactic that fits that situation, not previous situations, but that situation and the factors you see there. So that, you know, that's kind of my whole take for rapid decision making on the fire ground. And, you know, if I could give another couple takeaways from this, we've said it 100 times, we have to say it again. The presence of thick, dark, turbulent smoke from any part of the building is the setup for a vent-restricted fire and the potential for explosive fire growth. And to use the old adage that a fire doubles in size every minute in the growth phase is downright dangerous, because a fire can grow 10, 20, 30 times its volume in just a few seconds if it's vent restricted and somehow finds air, either by our actions or by something else, right? So that's it's a foundation to make decisions for your next fire. And we have to make those decisions with a strong consideration of what you're bringing to the party and how they deploy and move inward. And we're seeing some pretty innovative things coming out there. I mean, single-person 500 GPM blitz lines, things like that. It's deployment of those that should be aggressive, and if it's appropriate for the need. And please stop making decisions based on the fire that you see. Make decisions on the explosiveness of the smoke you see, because that's what's going to make things change so quickly. And you got to be ahead of that. And we know that for that single-person blitz line or a two-and-a-half transitional attack from the outside of the building, all those things, still, there's not many fire departments that can pull that off in less than 2 minutes from the time the driver operator sets the parking brake to the time they're flowing water out that useful orifice. So you have to have that kind of that command of what is reasonable. What can I reasonably do with the stress resources that we're working with at this fire?
Well, and it's going to come back to the bottom line is we've got to do education. And I think education is the key. Education is more than just training. Education is true learning that we bring to the table that the fire service today has got to embrace. And let's talk just a little bit about that education. And, Dave, I'm going to stay with you here. I know that you have just a number of different articles and books and different things out. I know that for our listeners, if you want to see just a brief synopsis of The Art of Reading Smoke, there's a, I don't know, it's probably a 10 or 12-minute video that you've got out on YouTube and, you know, various other things. You want to talk a little bit about how some of these folks can really look at, you know, the education and the information that you're delivering here and where they can go get that?
Yeah, I'm excited about the efforts that are out there. And more people are jumping on to the Reading Smoke, Reading Buildings component and developing all kinds of resources. You can just go to YouTube and search on Reading Smoke, and you'll get some examples there. There's products out there that some of the publishers are putting out, training DVDs, that sort of thing. You can search and query on that and pick that up. The other neat things is we're starting to see some changes in what I consider the kind of the hallmark books, what John Norman has put in his Fire Officer Handbook of Tactics, what John Mittendorf is writing, his new edition of his truck company operations book is coming out, and there's going to be all kinds of good information on Reading Smoke, Reading Building there. I encourage everybody, and I know this is not everybody's cup of tea, but if you read the UL lab reports and the NIST reports, some great stuff is coming out of that. And if you have the mind for it and dig into some of the data, it's actually pretty good stuff, and it gives you a handle, and just in your head you can picture your next fire based on some of the data people are collecting from this. So the sources are gaining. We're probably not where we should be, and it certainly hasn't hit the state curriculum levels and the certification and the standards and stuff like that, but there are some step forward resources coming out there that firefighters can access. Certainly Chris probably has a list of some things he's seen recently too that just become good resources for for firefighters to grab hold of and train and educate themselves. And if you're waiting for your training division, or you're waiting for your battalion chief on your shift, or your duty officer for your company to come out and teach you that stuff, you're going to be way, way behind. And it's not their fault. It's not their fault. There's all kinds of priorities we're all dealing with. But that internal drive in each of us has to be there looking at that stuff and building our ability to do SA and make better tactical decisions.
Oh, Chris, over to you. Fill us in on some of these things that I know you know about.
No, absolutely. And again, Dave just eloquently just put it all in the real right frame perspective. You know, instead of reading the latest who's who about what may have happened in the entertainment industry or some other gossip column, if you can get the guys and gals out there to go to the NIST page, go to the SFPE, Society of Fire Protection Engineers website, go to the UL website, there is a phenomenal level of highly technical but relevant information that puts all of the things that we've been talking about here on this program all together. The blog sites that are out there, which are numerous, I mean, we can talk about, and I'll just blatantly plug in the Firehouse Structural Anatomy of Buildings on Fire blog column that I have right on firehouse.com. I mean, there are a multitude of great blog sites, great websites that distill and put some information readily available to you to understand these concepts. And again, you don't have to have that PhD or the master's degree to start understanding them, but as you hear more and more of the commonalities of terms that we're utilizing, of the theories that are behind some of the things that we've been talking about, suddenly you start mentally putting it all together. And then, again, recognizing and starting to think about this stuff in the field, understanding the buildings, looking at the structures as you go through them on your day-to-day calls, or more importantly, the one thing that I've always advocated is getting out into the construction sites, taking a look at how the buildings are being built, you know, from ground level up, how they're being renovated, how they're being modified, and so forth. I mean, there's just so much information that's so readily available to any emerging or practicing officer or up-and-coming firefighter that's out there, far more than any of us on the old end of the scale may have had in years past. I mean, I can remember having to wait for the latest edition of a trade journal and Firehouse magazine coming in and so forth to start reading up on a particular job and the latest information from the who's who of fire service leaders in the day. But now you literally can go in and do a quick search or go onto your favorite website and get this information that's right there. And it's just such a vast amount of it. The podcasting elements, all of those kinds of things, I mean, again, there's a lot of valuable information. You just need to seek it out. And more importantly, take that information and see how it fits in your world. You know, all of this stuff doesn't have an entire relevancy to every single organization. We have to recognize that the size of your organization, its composition, the frequency, the severity of the alarms that you get in, the experience level of your organizational structuring, and again, the positives and the negative attributes, the things that help you as well as those things that sometimes challenge your organization in delivering its service are things that you have to take into account. So when we talk about all of these different elements, again, they all have to filter and distill down to how can you make it work in your organization, in your community, and how does it all sort of balance out based upon the risk factors that exist in every single one of those locations. The one biggest thing, and I'll give you my quick takeaways, again, it's no longer the brute force and the sheer physical determination that defines structural fire suppression operations. And again, any seasoned command or company officer knows that at times that is what gets the job done or under the most demanding of circumstances. But really, from what we've been talking about, we're looking at a methodological, disciplined approach and perspective toward aggressive firefighting that's built upon understanding the built environment. It's associated with goal-oriented tactics that are defined by risk assessment analyze strategic processes and that are executed under battle plans that, again, promote the best in safety practices and survivability within the hostile environments that we're operating under. And again, the demands of our modern firefighting, as well as the demands on the buildings and modern construction, you know, they require the placement of our personnel in situations and buildings that carry risk and uncertainty and this inherent danger, but we've got to balance that all out with fluid and integrated intelligent tactics, conscientious perspectives, and not look at our operations from a fatalistic standpoint, but recognize them for the risk probabilities that exist and put the right strategies and tactics in place to do the job safely. And it all sort of boils down to that comment that I made early on in the show, and that's tactical patience. It's slowing down enough in our operation that we're taking in the big picture, taking in all of these performance indicators and visual stimulations and so forth, and processing it all based upon all of the elements that we've talked about here on the show, and coming up with the right strategy and tactic for that particular building at that particular time in the street in your operation.
Wow, just a vast amount of information. A ton of blogs that are out there. I mean, there's a plethora of stuff. On firehouse.com, on other sites. Let's go to some final comments here. Rick, you got any final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, actually I do, kind of thinking, looking back at some of the stuff that Pat hit on earlier. You know, as a company officer, you know, I tell my guys every day there's three important things. It's rig in service, is your personal protective equipment in service, and are you well trained? You know, I think that's a great way to lead the day, because it really gives you, you know, as long as those three components are there, we can make the emergency call and we can handle the situations the best that we can. I think other things, you know, as a company officer, especially in this rapid changing environment, you know, YouTube's a great way to sit there and watch some videos and make some tactical decisions in your head or jot them down on note paper. One of the other things that, you know, in my traveling training that I do throughout the year, you know, I take my digital camera with me, and having fire service mentors in different cities, you know, I always go out with them, and we look through buildings, and I take some snapshots, stuff that I can bring back to the firefighters that I work with, and bring back to the department. You know, and the other thing, too, is find some mentors out there in some busy departments that fight fire on a regular basis and go take a ride with them. You know, whether it's on an engine, a truck, or in a chief's buggy, you can take a ride with them. Take your camera, you know, and go along for the ride. I've gotten a lot of great experience over the years of just doing that, and have seen a number of different things that I never would have saw if I would have stayed in my little enclosed box right in the Kansas City Metro. So I think that you got to get outside the box. You got to think quick, rapid decision making. And you got to think, how can I keep my crews safe? And you know, for the other officers out there and for the firefighters, you know, you're not alone. You know, if you're dealing with hard-headed individuals in your apartment, you're not alone. We all deal with them. It's just that you got to think of some strategies to make your company safe and to make it a safe environment for your people. And if they want to get on board, they can get on board. But you got to just keep in mind that, you know, as an officer, those guys are your responsibility, so you've got to be educated, and you've got to do whatever you can to make yourself an educated company officer so that you can survive in today's fire environment.
Well, I'm going to slide over to you, Pat. Any final comments?
Well, I think, you know, at this point, you know, listen to Rick and listen to the whole game tonight. You know, I echo a lot of the same comments. I think one thing we have to do, fire chiefs, chief officers, and from the command perspective, we have to step up. I think that it's time to step up and stop allowing the unsafe acts to take place on the fire ground. We have to supervise. We have to see the big picture. It's hard to see the big picture when you get focused on those little or small parts of the incident. We have to look at everything, every component. we as chief officers have to understand that same building construction and realize that, hey, this environment is not good for our people, and take those necessary steps to get them out of harm's way. My boss calls it intestinal fortitude. I think we have to have that. We have to put that back into play as chief officers. And, you know, one of the things, you know, that we hear the comments, everybody goes home. We have to make that real and not lip service. And a lot of, and I won't say a lot of places, but in some places it becomes lip service. It's really neat, again, to go through the processes and say we really do all this for our people. But we have to make that the state of mind for all of our people. It's tough. It's difficult. We're going to have some hard heads in there probably. But you know what? We keep fighting the fight and really stand strong in making the difference in today's fire service. Again, I still go back to our basic firefighting programs. We really have to look at what we're doing there as a fire service and what we accept as acceptable practices and what we teach our young people coming into the service. Then we have to go back to the company officers and really support them and really encourage them and get that passion back in the fire service to stay alive, to do the right things. Some of the things that, you know, that we talked about earlier with GPMs, I think that we have to really look at that. What we, you know, we've become the 1¾-inch society, and it's just we continue to utilize our small hand lines against big monsters, and we're losing battles, and we're going to end up losing a war if we're not careful on that. Situational awareness, I can't say enough about that. I think it's very critical that we practice those things. I think we have to create real-world environments for our firefighters, our fire officers, and really, really, really focus on making those good strategic and tactical decisions when we arrive on the scene of the fires that we see today, and know that the fire that we see today will probably be totally different tomorrow. It may even be different in the same day at a different location. So we really have to do that, practice those things, and we have to keep fighting the fight.
Well, Chris, I'm going to be remiss if I didn't throw out, if we're really looking for a dynamic in training, a way to get our company officers a true engagement and a true resources is to look to what Dave, yourself, and I have been involved in for many a year and what paved the way for opportunities and the knowledge that we have, and that's the International Society of Fire Service Instructors. With your closing comments here, how about just talking a little bit about what ISFSI is doing and what it has to offer our listeners?
I think the biggest thing that, again, from our perspective, and I'll give you my firsthand account. I got involved in the ISFSI as an up-and-coming company officer a long, long time ago, and it gave me the direction that I needed. It gave me the insights. It gave me perspective. It also tempered much of that sort of unbridled enthusiasm that was going in the wrong direction by having the right mentors and the right influence and the right perspective on things through reading, through involvement, and so forth. The ISFSI certainly is a very well-suited organization for a firefighter, for the company officer, for the emerging or practicing command and company officer and firefighter, any one of the rank structures. But much of what the organization has to offer is the ability for networking, for timely, quality information that's cutting edge, instilling upon the fire service the attributes of tradition, but also promoting the cutting-edge concepts that make us all better firefighters, and certainly as we move into the instructional ranks, better company officers and instructors to move it all forward. And certainly a lot of the things that the society is developing and rolling out here of late. You know, we had a grant program that we utilized to roll out an exceptional program that we distributed out to all of the members, both in terms of ISFSI as well as the iChief Safety, Health, and Survival section, was a CD and informational package on modern firefighting and the effects of what we've been talking about tonight on building instruction. Just some hard and fast, useful information that the company officer in particular, where the focal point was to increase that knowledge base and increase some real basic concepts, much of what we've talked about tonight, and get it out into the field. Because, again, the challenge is on training. How do I get the information? How do we get quality, professionally developed instructional information? And, again, that's where the society steps in to fill those voids, fill those gaps, both in terms of that type of product as well as the information that we have available on our website. Again, a lot of great information that's tied in, cutting-edge, timely distributed information through that, as well as our partnerships through a number of our different organizations that provide our content management and informational items. So that's sort of the real quick and dirty. It's really a great organization that puts together the right minds in the fire service, from the small rural fire department all the way to the largest metropolitan organization on the national level, as well as participation on an international level, to really make the fire service what it is, and that's that brotherhood and sharing, so that we're all able to really truly go home at the end of the day.
And I will throw out too that the society has just launched an instructor credentialing program, which is just going to be phenomenal. It's going to help people develop and grow as instructors, and I think it's really going to have an impact on the fire service in the long term. Plus, we're also doing the Live Fire Instructor Trainer, which is a credential process of trying to get better instructors in teaching our fire behavior and teaching our people, you know, the right things in the field. Last but not least, I would be remiss if I didn't give a heartfelt thank you out to both you and Dave, Chris, for being great mentors as I came into that organization, and you have been great mentors to many fire service people along the way and through the years, and just a heartfelt thank you from the fire service to your guys' efforts. You have been listening to Training and Tactics Talk, and I want to thank our guests for being on the show and their efforts that are tremendously impacting America and the world's fire service. Training and Tactics is dedicated to providing that cutting-edge training and the tactical concepts that provide our fire service the necessary predicated knowledge, skills, and abilities, the tools that are going to help them be effective, efficient, and safe, and focusing on that efforts and not giving lip service, as Pat Wilson said, to the efforts of everyone going home. We're looking forward to a power-packed 2011 year. Some of the future programs that you're going to be able to hear on Training and Tactics Talk is how to develop quality training programs. There's going to be more on this topic that we've talked about, this tactical renaissance and this new rules of fire combat engagement. We're going to be looking at back to the new basics, street-level training and tactics for today. I am your host, Douglas Klein, and we hope to see you on a future Training and Tactics Talk program. Till next time, train hard, train often, and stay safe.
The best way to learn a new skill or improve upon one you already have is to actually put it into practice. Choose from 6 hands-on training classes at Firehouse World 2011 in San Diego this coming February. Classes include trench rescue, firefighter survival, air management, extrication, and more. Learn by doing. Complete details available at firehouseworld.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.